everyone. Welcome back to the Stratcom podcast. I am very pleased to be joined today by Mr. Jan Sart. Jan Sart is currently the director of the NATO Strategic Communications Center of Excellence here in Riga. And prior to that, he was the state secretary at the Ministry of Defense of Latvia and chair of the National Cybersecurity Board. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I would like to actually begin our conversation today by discussing the period in the buildup to the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine. It seems that for weeks, if not months, we had been hearing reports about an imminent invasion, and this was typically sourced from the US or UK intelligence community. It was kind of leaked to the media, so to say. Could you tell me about this strategy of deliberate leaking? From a strategic communications perspective, what was it trying to accomplish?
Well, obviously they were trying to accomplish was to avert the war, and in a way also to make it more complicated for Russia to stage the pretext for war. In my view, I think that was the right thing to do. And of course, right now in hindsight, when we see what has been happening, now documents increasingly available, when the orders were made, which is obviously some time before the actual invasion. I think that was A, surprise, this strategy to Russia. B, it really made them adjust their plans relative to what US were communicating. And I'll explain how and why in my view. First, I remember back in 2017, I was asked to testify in the US Senate on the matter of Russian interference. Mm-hmm. And one of my observations back then was that Russians quite well knew that the intelligence agencies of the West and US in particular would be aware of their plans. But they counted that, as is typical for the intelligence agencies, they will keep that to themselves, they'll do briefings, but as a classified information, it will stay there. So in the information space, they will have freedom of maneuver, they'll be able to muddy the ground and have the initiative. And even back then, I said that has to be reconsidered. The approach to intelligence information in a 21st century information warfare situation has to be reconsidered. And clearly that is what I think US has clearly done. I believe internally some of the people that were running these this campaign were cognizant of a risk, because at some point, of course, we all saw that it looked not comfortable. They were presenting the information, although of course they had to guard the sources, so not very much detail, just like the statements. And that was not a comfortable position for the US government. I think we all remember the videos from press conference of the State Department and the challenges by the members of the media, mm-hmm, back then. But what we can tell now is that Russians had to adjust. Let's take a look at the pretext of why they went in. Right now, it's extremely clumsy.
The kind of claims of genocide.
Genocide, no pictures, nothing. There's like, you know, only if you're glued to the Russian Kremlin TV, then you might have an option to believe it. But I don't believe that was the original plan. I do believe the original plan was very different, to have the videos, to have staged, but because of the disclosures, you know, it's very difficult to go that route if somebody just said, well, you're going to do that.
Yep.
So, and that is, I think, one part of the reason why we can claim right now when we do this podcast is that Russia has lost information campaign element, at least in the West, not to mention Ukraine, fair and square, you know, 10-0. And that is, I think, partly due to this approach by the US and UK and using this Stratcom approach to this.
So if this approach had not been pursued, Russia could have launched a more effective false flag operation, created a more credible excuse for invading, that would have muddied the waters.
Absolutely. I think what we wouldn't have seen the same level and the same speed of unifying the Western world. It would go there eventually, in my view. But the ability to muddy the water as they did in 14 and 15 to a certain extent would have been greater. But there, of course, that was not the only element in the picture. There were a number of other elements in the picture. And after all, we've learned our lessons in the West. But still, that was overtaking the initiative in the information space. Although, of course, at some parts of a time, you could see that Russian campaign on their part was that their kind of propaganda campaign, information warfare campaign, was led from the top leadership down through all the structures, kind of doing the same message, which is typically what they're kind of good at.
You say that the West has won the information warfare, the informational dimension of this conflict with respect to Western audiences, sure. With respect to Ukrainian audiences, sure. But what about the Russian domestic audience? What about the people behind the so-called informational Iron Curtain? What sort of narratives are they exposed to? Have we had any success at breaching this Iron Curtain, at explaining to ordinary Russians what actually their government is doing against the neighboring country?
Well, that unfortunately is not as much of a success story. Clearly, and there's of course not much data available right now on Russia, but I think we can tell from a number of different sources, some of the opinion polls still around, some of the kind of recounts of the people within Russia, there is clearly a sizable part of a Russian population. I would at this point say probably majority of the Russian population that still go with the Kremlin narrative, and that is that it is there was atrocities committed by Ukraine in Donbas and Luhansk, that they are liberating Ukraine from Nazis, neo-Nazis, and nationalists. That people in Ukraine are thankful for being liberated, that in fact they're just fighting the elite in Kiev and Lviv, so nationalist hotbed in Ukraine, and they're doing a very efficient surgical operation. Of course, if you hear these words, it's kind of, how can people still believe? Because it's the lie of the size of Orwellian books, where black is white, war is peace, bad is good. And yet, of course, in a modern information environment, people still have access to other kinds of information. But that's where human psychology comes in. And I think when they bought into that story, they process all of that through that story, A, and B, waking up from that story is going to be psychologically and otherwise tremendously painful. So they're blocking that option. And I think that's one of the way the humans are built in, they're now blocking that option, not only because they believe, but also because of the consequences accepting of what is happening and where they themselves have been in this kind of picture of things.
But to what extent do they actually have alternative narratives available to them? For example, the Kremlin just announced that they're shutting down Echo Moskvy, and, well, any kind of remaining independent or opposition media are getting completely suffocated in Russia. The space, the public space for debate on any of these issues is really almost non-existent.
So, well, I'll tell you straightforward, I'm old enough that spent some time of my life in the Soviet Union. I'd say they're going into the early 80s of the last century, of the way they handled the information. So it's really like, you know, tremendous step back. They try to control, they try to kind of, you know, you can't mention the word war.
Yeah.
You can't, like, you know, these kind of awkward things and et cetera. Of course, the world is not anymore in 1980s. So that's the difference. I'm pretty much sure that people in Moscow and St. Petersburg have a pretty good understanding of what is happening. But as many people have repeatedly said, Moscow and St. Petersburg don't represent the typical Putin supporter. So we're going to see, but of course we are all increasingly also getting this notion of people getting this news of the numbers that Russia have lost in Ukraine, and actually starting to recognize how much different the reality is from what they've been seeing. And most of the people that kind of have got this news about their children,
the coffins start coming home.
They are coming home right now.
Yeah.
And that's where I think it kicks in. And clearly the other thing that we have to put into this perspective is right now, what Russian military leadership and leadership at large has done, they've reverted to what they know. They just throw more people into the grinder, of course, on a Ukrainian side for sure, but also on their own side.
Mm.
And that is, I think, one of these notions that we've not seen yet take full effect in the Russian society. And also, what is important, in a ways and means that, you know, no Western government, military leadership would ever imagine throwing their own military basically to the death because of incompetence, unpreparedness, no logistic, just go and die. That's what they are right now saying to their soldiers.
Thank you for this. Could you shed some light on the informational dimension or on the strategic communications dimension of the actual conflict? For instance, there have been lots of reports of Russia planting fakes in the information space with the aim of kind of destabilizing society or maybe demoralizing the Ukrainian troops. One notable fake, of course, was a report alleging that President Zelensky had left the country, and that managed to get some traction before it was debunked. What are some trends you are seeing? Are there any worrying developments? Are the Russians doing anything new? What are you seeing?
I don't see much new, although, of course, these things that we talk about are basically focused on Ukraine. So what we've seen, yes, we've seen Zelensky has left the country. He's fled. The government has surrendered. The Kiev is encircled by the Russian troops, some of which were kind of not that sophisticated. This idea of encirclement of Kiev really got a lot of traction. The Associated Press got kind of fooled, as much as also a number of the Ukrainian outlets. But I would say also this, the more they do that right now, and, you know, people kind of recognize, okay, that was false, the more they inoculate population against the further. So it's not like you can repeat and repeat and repeat and continue with having success. With a good information resistance from the Ukrainian side by exposing and kind of doing a very good stratcom, which I commend President Zelensky, like, hats off. They're losing their potential of impact. So next time there will be a news, okay, Zelensky has surrendered, I think nobody would even kind of raise an eyebrow on that news, because they, well, I think no one now believes that he is the guy that will surrender.
So do you think this shows that, of course, Russian aggression against Ukraine is nothing new. It goes back to 2014 and even intimidation before. But do you think this shows that Ukrainian society has become more resilient, considering it has been engaged in this conflict from 2014, that no more it can be caught kind of sleeping, no more surprises are possible, new layers of resistance have been built?
Well, of course, they have become much more resilient. And we shouldn't forget that's the nation at war. That also has shown tremendous courage. And that, of course, brings out a very different dimension of the society. Of course, some of these things are kind of still there, but I think you should not discount 8 years of preparations, which is a war was ongoing. I think the decisions to cut down the Russian information channels, now we can say, which was criticized by quite a lot of European countries back then, has really been a very good idea, that the results of which we see right now. And I would recommend many countries to look at it seriously as a good option.
Well, we're looking at it in this country, right?
Yes, and not only in Latvia. And this is actually paid off because, well, you don't treat them as media. They're tools of influence. Mm-hmm. That's what they are. And I'm not talking only of the TV channels, but I'm talking also on some other levels like VK and Klasnikin, etc. The second thing is the way they've started the war, you know, being as clumsy and in a way also here, US preparing, there's an invasion and actually making them like not believing at that point, but when they see that is coming, they kind of, the puzzle comes together. And of course, what has been the success recently is the humanization of the war by Ukrainians. Yeah. It's not just like the big battles, Kharkiv, etc. It's the human faces that they're putting up front, and actually, I'm not sure, but this notion, this Russian warship, go fuck yourself, or in Russian, Ruskiy voyennyy korabl poshel nakhuy, idi nakhuy. This has really kind of electrified a lot of people. And although, of course, it uses, the language that is not typically, but it has...
It seems to be appropriate in this context.
Not only appropriate, but you're also kind of, it becomes a folklore. It's the kind of epitome of a spirit, why it has been taken up by so many others. So, and that's another thing is, and it's not been deliberate, but also when you go back to the resistance to the Nazis in the Second World War, in many places, mm-hmm. symbols matter. Mm-hmm. Symbols are really, in these cases, incredibly powerful elements. And in the first days of war, they had a few symbols. They were not artificially created. They just emerged by themselves. And that is also something that we have to remember in that situation, that really was a rallying point for Ukrainians to have a further heroic act, and also for us.
This is interesting because on the question of symbols, President Putin is also one who likes to play around with a kind of glorious historic narratives, these kind of themes to rally the population, but it doesn't seem that he's been effective in this.
His symbol now is that table. and not anymore the one that he meets Macron or Scholz, but the one he meets his own people. Like, I don't know how many meters is there, but also I'm struck by the idea that the people in and around him are ready to put these images up, mm-hmm. because the story that is being told by that video is pretty straightforward and certainly not beneficial to President Putin. So in all matters of symbols, He might like them, but he's created for himself a different that he would like himself.
I won't ask you to delve into the realm of conspiracy with me. Let's leave that for me on my own time. But what would you say that this signals a level of paranoia within the Putin regime? Do you think that maybe the pre-bunking tactics that we discussed before have signaled to him that, look, we have sources close to you. Your inner circle is leaking information. Do you think this is a kind of impacting the way the regime operates now?
Yeah, it's we're really getting into, once again, back to the Cold War, the Kremlinology. and the people that are like, you know, he blinked an eye, and et cetera, which happened back in the West in '80s. But I'm kind of, in the '80s, I was on the other side. So I have a bit of a kind of different view of these things. So I think first, it's normal that people that are at the tip of a power, increasingly autocratic power, for more than 20 years, they start to surround themselves with people that are not telling truth. That's happens everywhere. Second, clearly, the self-isolation for 2 years in a bunker or wherever, also with a very, very limited group of people circled around, has not helped. So what I think what we see is, first and foremost, a person that had not grasp of the realities. And, you know, for many thinking that Putin is extremely rational, calculating player,
chess player.
Yeah, I'd say he's more in a judo player. And of course, I'm pained to compare such a sport to somebody like that, because I love judo. But he's more like, you know, what do you do in judo? You try to kind of get the other off the balance and use the moment. Mm. So extremely tactical. No chess, no. I'd say game of rugby.
Yeah.
That's probably another parallel. Extremely tough, extremely kind of looking at the momentarily the options. But of course, he's been rational. And I'm not claiming right now he's not rational. He just doesn't know what is the reality. Mm. As simple as that. Neither in the Russian military, nor in Ukrainian military, nor in Ukrainian society, nor in the world at large. So he didn't have a clue when he'd made that decision. Right now, obviously, he's not only seeing that somebody is leaking out in his inner circle, or their means were, you know, US has a very in-depth view of what is happening, really. Plus, he's now realized the world he knew actually didn't exist. So, of course, that kind of, and now we're kind of in the levels of assumptions. Clearly, the emotions might be running extremely high right now.
Well, that episode where he kind of publicly embarrassed his intelligence chief, I guess, suggests the level of obedience and power hierarchy that exists in the people that surround him, in the sense that he's surrounded by people who feel the need to please him with the information they provide him. They bring him news that he wants to see, information that he would deem.
Yeah, well, that's clear. And that's what led him to make such a miscalculation as he did, which it is, of course. But also, one has to remember that that was prior of all the failures. So, and also that was, it was pre-filmed. Yeah. So there was a choice to leave that piece in. And clearly, therefore, I kind of see that he was trying to give, by and large, three messages from that. A, all the elite has had kind of a say in a decision. Second, that he is undeniable kind of tsar in that surrounding. And third, the reason that piece was left in is how people are afraid of him. And that was not by chance. That was by design. And that has to be. But also, in a way, if you think through that, it tells about weakness. Because if you're feeling strong, these kind of signals would not be necessary. They would be perceived different from a different ways. If you're compelled to show it, that means that in fact you feel weak, and back to your original point, probably fearful.
We briefly touched upon him in one of the previous questions, but I'm quite curious to hear your analysis on the role that individual political leaders can play in the strategic communications dimension of this battle. And of course, it would be amiss not to ask about the role of President Zelensky. It seems that he's become quite a rock star, not only within his own country, where his popularity has skyrocketed. I think it's in the 90s now. Democratically elected political leader would only dream of this, but also among Western audiences, he's become a cult figure, so to say. The bravery he has shown is really beyond debate, I would say. Can you tell me more about kind of how the messaging and positioning of President Zelensky has made an impact in reaching wider audiences?
Yes, I think he's now the symbol of Ukraine, both within Ukraine, but also outside. And it's interesting to say that, like, you know, 2 months ago, we would be talking about Ukrainian Stratcom. I think very few people would say that's extremely successful. And that is something where you have to say that in times like these, personalities matter. Of course, there's a team around that writes the speeches. Of course, there's a kind of consultation when to go, what to do. But clearly, President Zelensky himself, as he is an asset. So this is the kind of president, the more you hear him in these kind of situations, under these kind of circumstances, the more you win. I think now there's more and more kind of recounts on his 5-minute speech effect on the European Council meeting, which kind of shifted quite a lot of dynamics back in Europe. So could it be pre-prepared? I don't think so. It is just that, as in times of war, there are leaders that raise up to the moment, and there are leaders that cannot. And clearly, in the comparison of President Zelensky and Putin, Putin has been not up to the task by any standard. Even though one would say that he's been really successful at putting his image, especially within Russia, and to a certain extent up to now, in the West. But Zelensky has really kind of become a symbol. And that's one of the reasons he's one of the primary targets of Russia. But by becoming a symbol, even by physically eliminating President Zelensky, there's no victory in that. It's actually an additional defeat.
Again, immobilizing.
And an additional defeat for Russia. So what I would take it as a lesson, that is something you cannot premeditate. You can have the overall environment control and et cetera, et cetera. But the leader that you have in these moments is, like, you know, what the nation has given to you, and that is, in this case, has worked extremely well, and very much due to the qualities of President Zelensky. And of course, the moment where his team had the exact necessary talents for these kinds of situations and notions. Other thing, of course, is that one has to accept, and I think both from the story of US Stratcom campaign, as well as from what has been the Zelensky's role, strategic communication capability within a nation is a strategic level capability that is part of your national security structure. Either you do it, that's a huge boost and potential. If you don't, it's a huge liability in times like these.
But just to unpack this a bit more, you said that Ukrainian Stratcom has been successful, at least in these past weeks and so on. But if we could unpack this a bit, kind of what lessons can we take about strategic communications during a time of crisis, in crisis context? What lessons can practitioners gather from how the Ukrainian government, from how the Ukrainian presidential administration has conducted itself?
Well, first, I think the notion is that it is important that every Ukrainian has become part also of the Ukrainian Stratcom effort. And that's what we see. And I'm struck that, okay, there are Stratcom entities within the military, within the government of Ukraine, and they're doing their job very, very successfully these days. But what really makes a difference is how much the society itself has bought into that narrative. How, you know, it takes a person on the street on Bucha with all the emotion that Grandpa had when he was filming these destroyed Russian equipment units, being on the street with all the emotion, and et cetera, et cetera, to really resonate. But would it happen out of the blue without the context that has been set by the Stratcom teams, the frameworks? Probably less successful. So, and many of the elements that we've seen delivering success to Ukraine, I don't think have been premeditated. It's been more like this idea: we set a framework and direction, and everybody thinks of how can I contribute to that. First. Second, it's that you need to create symbols, and the best is that you have your leaders as a symbols. And that is where you have to really maneuver around. In some cases, you probably might not have, you know, your top leadership as capable mm-hmm. to do so. Should it stop? No. You should look for one. You should kind of, and that's the professional part of it. I think that you have to create somebody that could become that symbol of a kind of will of people, readiness to resist or do whatever the crisis is delivering. So there has to be one that becomes symbol both within. Hopefully that's the same symbol that is for those that are outside. That's another one. Mm-hmm. Third is you have to have pre-prepared plans on shelves. Of course, it's not like they'll go like you've planned them yeah. to go, but at least both the materials, the kind of processes, coordination mechanisms, they all have to be in place and prior practiced, because this is not a moment where you can, you know, and in some cases, of course, we know they had to be reinvented as it is being done. But you clearly see the value of pre-prepared elements, and that is another thing. And in a way, kind of go through the kind of full spectrum of Stratcom in a sense of also, okay, there's a large-scale war. Let's practice it out. Let's practice it out, how it's going to happen, how we're going to work on that, what kind of things we might need. And of course, right now,
And are such practices taking place now within the NATO?
Well, increasingly more so. Of course, we need to invest more into that, and there are mechanisms both also in the NATO center. Our center of excellence is being created, but that is, I think, a clear takeaway. Mm. Just take a look how important element it is in this war. Yeah. And therefore, we have to prepare for that.
We, as you said, the both Russian military, but also the Russian regime, the Kremlin, have been quite clumsy in the way they've conducted themselves, both in terms of the coming up with excuses for intervention, but also they've made tactical blunders on the ground, making all sorts of embarrassing logistical mistakes. But yet, I would like to ask about the Russia's ability to learn from its mistakes. So for instance, an episode that comes to mind is during its invasion in 2014 of Eastern Ukraine and annexation of Crimea, the Russian soldiers who didn't have any insignia on their uniform, they kind of exposed their operations by posting selfies, you know, with tanks and so on. And this was well documented by journalists, and they got exposed. Surely similar mistakes are not being made now, right? So Russian soldiers are not posting TikToks as they run into Ukrainian cities. So do you think that for all its flaws, for all its lack of democratic accountability and transparency, and maybe this degree of paranoia, what do you assess as the readiness of the regime to learn?
They've clearly taken away the smartphones from, and phones by and large, from their military. That actually led to an even bigger mistake. And that is that the only material around global social media that we see of the war of Ukraine is Ukrainian. Mm. And I think that has been one of the reasons why they've lost so heavily in the information space, and why you'd say most governments don't have a space for maneuver because of the way their societies react to it. And the societies react because of what they see in social media. And of course, you might see it slightly differently if you're in VK or Odnoklassniki, which is a Russian.
These closed messaging groups where God knows what's happening.
But by and large, nobody in the world is on those apart from Russians in Russia and a few small groups elsewhere. So, yes, they adjusted, not immediately, after some time, but that led them into the trap. Hmm. And I think I see a consistent pattern. Russian military leadership is just bad. No way to, you know, logistics, non-existent. Tactically, you know, such a stupid choices, like, as I've said, just putting people to die. You know, non-secure communications, like 21st century was, you know, I've been always the kind of skeptical mind on the Russian military capability because of my experiences in when I was young in the Soviet times. But even I'm surprised. And this once again, okay, they've took all the smartphones, and that delivered them a defeat. Aren't you able to know where they are because the smartphones are not with them? You can, of course you can. There are other ways you can do it. The only thing is, you cannot directly message to the soldiers, which is probably the only thing that they protecting them. Because of course, if the soldiers would like had a stream of what is really happening, their spirits would be quite quickly going through. So of course it has accomplished certain level of effect, which is like short term, in my view, because of course they will be aware increasingly about what is expecting them when they start engaging. But yet that cost them entire kind of social media environment.
Another kind of hot water issue that has come about in the recent days is the role of big social media platforms in this conflict. For instance, companies like Netflix are being forced by the Russian government to comply with new censorship rules. As we discussed, Russia's trying to more and more kind of insulate its information space from any competing content or any other information. What role have they played in this conflict? Do you see that Facebook or, for example, Google, have they in any way cleaned up their act in terms of the spread of Russian disinformation, or have they been any better?
Yeah, yeah, of course they've reacted. There's no doubt in that, that they're trying to do most they can. Although, of course, I think they have to start understand that there is no business options anymore left in Russia. And I'd say I would view their operations in Russia as actually part of trying to, you know, not as a business anymore. Because in times of war, and although the war is small, but by and large, Russia is waging the war against the West as your effort that you can do to let the Russian people know what is happening. So yes, by and large, they've done what I would have expected of a democratic country's companies to do. Has it been to the full extent? Have they gone through all of it? Not really. Of course, there's more that they can do, and in some cases by blocking Doge and et cetera, in some places. I think they've taken the moral route that is unsustainable for them. And I hope they will quite kind of learn of the mistake and reverse it. But also what I was interested to learn, and I don't at this point have more details, but there's more news coming out as the traffic on Twitter from Russia has been kind of stopped. Some of the very powerful anti-government movements in the Western countries have disappeared. Which is a kind of interesting, if that happens to be true. But I think very interesting to investigate further. Something once these things are sorted out, hopefully in a good way, that we have to really dig in and understand what really has happened and actually have a very serious talk if what I suspect is the reason for this sudden kind of drop of this movement on some of these social platforms was a social media companies.
Mm-hmm. Maybe before we conclude, I would like to ask you a bit more of a philosophical or existential question that maybe I think lots of people are asking themselves. As you said, the Ukrainians are winning the information war. There is no doubt about it. Truth is on the Ukrainian side. But does truth even matter? Does morality matter? Does moral legitimacy matter if you lose the war? What is truth worth?
Well, imagine the world where truth doesn't matter. We can go back to the famous Orwellian books, which were a big hit once you could access them back in the Soviet Union, because we were living in a semi-Orwellian world back then. The life is miserable in these circumstances, and it's not worth kind of fooling ourselves that, you know, life in the world of somebody designing, you know, full scale, you know, how you gonna perceive the world around us and control everything you're gonna see, which is where Russia is trying to go right now, is a miserable existence, especially in the times of 21st century, where so much of interesting things happening, so much new breakthroughs are taking place, and potentials and options, travel, you know, seeing other cultures, interacting with so many different people. part of not having truce is you don't have any of that. Mm. And so truce is or kind of valuing the truce. Well, we in democratic societies, we know truce is evasive. We sometimes screw things up ourselves. But yet we are persistently trying to reach out, to try to reach the truth. Is it worth fighting for? It is. Because truth is part and parcel of the value set of, you know, being free, being able to choose, being able to decide your own future. Mm-hmm. This is part and parcel. Once you take away truth, the other pieces also go away. You're neither free, nor you have choices on your own. Somebody else chooses it for you, as well as your options are decided by somebody else. So clearly, Ukraine is fighting for their identity as being able to be Ukrainians if they wish so. They're fighting for democracy, but democracy's core element is striving to establish truce. Not always succeeding, yeah. but the kind of this idea of striving for one is there. And that's therefore, in my view, part of the reason of war, because I don't know what happens in the Putin's head of talking about in these 19th century imperialistic categories, what kind of books he has read, what he has seen. But certainly in that part, truce is not something that masses should have. By and large, I would say from Putin's perspective, I think people are objects that are, like, you know, disposable by the greats of that. And certainly I don't like the idea of living in that kind of world. And therefore, I think it's part and parcel of the war.
I think this has given us so much food for thought. Thank you so much for joining us. It was a true pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.